All right. So to kick off, we are going to talk about, I was just chatting to the ladies, a topic that probably wasn't as popular for a setting like this without it being the situation that we find ourselves in right now. We're going to talk about inflation, right? Will it get better? Will it get worse? What exactly is happening right now? So even the average Joe like myself, who's not particularly in the industry, is very keen to hear about how can I combat and fight against this monster that seems to be eating at my pocket every time I have a look, called inflation, right? So I'm going to introduce my panelists. I have the privilege of spending some time with three amazing ladies. So I'll be the thorn amongst the roses here. So as I call them up, they will just join me on stage, please. I will just come on the side. Okay, so first up, we have Melanie Stockett, who's a portfolio manager at Laurium, focused on fixed income portfolios. She was the founding member of Tantalum Capital, where for 15 years she was head of fixed interest and the portfolio manager for the fixed income portfolios. Melanie started her career at Standard Corporate and Merchant Bank and was also at Coronation Fund Managers shortly after that, where she was head of fixed interest team. Thank you for joining us, Melanie.
If you could
please give a round of applause. And then we're going to have Zisanda Chila, who is the senior portfolio manager within the fixed income team at Momentum Investments. She was previously with Metropolitan Asset Managers as a fixed income trader, and she currently manages the money market portfolios in her current role. Her approach to investing has actually helped her clients gain excess returns above benchmarks, and she and the team have been recognized with multiple awards in this particular space as the best South African interest-bearing short-term fund on a risk-adjusted basis. So very accomplished lady. Please give her a round of applause. And then my last panelist, we have Sanisha Pakrisamy. She is an economist at Momentum, has been with the company for over 10 years, and she previously represented RMB Asset Management as an economic analyst. Sanisha also provides input to Momentum Investments Division within a macro framework. This is used to inform investment opportunities and strategies. She's also a regular economic commentator on various media platforms, so I'm sure some of you might have been reading her column on the Financial Mail, which is on a monthly basis. So, yeah, that goes about and summarizes my panel. Finally, it feels like we've been knowing each other for forever. But, yeah, so, guys, please, my ask to you is that let's engage. We'll have a Q&A session just shortly after this discussion. We really want you to participate in the debate. The idea is for all of us to, of course, come out of today's session having engaged robustly, having grown, and having come out better than we came in. That's really my ask from my side. So if we could make down some notes, I will give you a chance later on to ask some questions. All right. Awesome. So I'll start off maybe with you, Sanisha. As I said, it's been an interesting journey over the last couple of years, financially speaking, socially speaking as well. So maybe if we could just start there, if you can give us a brief summary, say take us from just pre-pandemic through the pandemic to where we are now. What is happening from an inflation point of view within the South African context? But also, is this mirrored globally? Is it contrasting? What's actually happening?
Testing this works. You know, it's quite strange that we are sitting here today and talking about how high inflation is, because just a couple of years ago, most of the major developed market central banks were actually worried about a phenomenon called disinflation, which is falling inflation rates. Mm. So if you think about that period between, 2014 to 2016, during that period, inflation in the US was actually closer to an average of 0.5%. Mm. in comparison to almost 9% today. If you look at what inflation was in the Eurozone over that period, which was closer to 0.33%. You know, and at that point, central banks then started to talk about having a more flexible approach to inflation targeting and speaking about maybe looking at average inflation targeting. So the Fed, I mean, as recent as August 2020, started talking about maybe looking at average inflation targeting around that 2% point. So not, you know, looking at hiking interest rates when inflation gets to 2%, but rather letting inflation run a bit hot for a bit longer because they were so worried about disinflation problems. And then, of course, you know, be careful what you ask for, because then we were smacked by the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think what made it very different this time around relative to the 70s is in the 70s we had supply issues that were causing inflation. This time around it was a confluence of supply as well as demand factors. So we know that, you know, nations around the world went on very strict lockdown, and so all the widgets and components and input components couldn't get to other areas of the world. And so that caused quite a lot of disruption with global supply chains. But then adding to that problem is that governments then, I mean, in some cases physically wrote out checks to consumers and to businesses so that they could spend in order to prop up economic activity. And so when lockdowns were eased, these very cash-flush consumers went out to buy all these widgets. Mm-hmm. But the companies that were producing the widgets didn't have enough to meet that demand. And so we had demand-led inflation on top of the cost push inflation. And we also had overlapping crises. So once we had started to emerge from the fourth wave of COVID-19, we then had Russia invading Ukraine.
Right.
And so there was another layer of price pressure that was added through the commodity price shock.
Yeah.
And then the next crisis unfolded when China then hit another bout of COVID cases, the worst since the pandemic had started. And so they insisted on having a very strict lockdown again.
Yeah.
And that just then exacerbated global supply chain problems. So that's really, you know, how we got to this point from disinflation to an inflation problem globally. And quite strangely, because South Africa generally follows global trends, this time around we actually bucked the global trend of rising inflation. So inflation didn't really get that far out of kilter with the inflation target domestically like it did in many other economies, bar the recent May inflation print. Okay. And I think, you know, one of the factors leading to that is the composition of our inflation basket. So traditionally speaking, in many emerging markets, a very big chunk of consumers' pockets are actually spent on things like food and on things like fuel. But in South Africa's case, about half of our basket is actually spent on services. And we know there was a huge overhang in the property market, and that caused rental price inflation to come down.
Yep.
We know that many, you know, medical aid companies, including our own, you know, kept the tariff quite low. And these are big components of the inflation basket. And so we had these idiosyncratic factors playing out that actually reined in inflation, unlike what we saw on the global stage. So is this similar to what we saw globally? Not really, because in the US, we actually had a broadening of price pressures because demand was so strong as these cash flush consumers went out to spend their money.
Right.
In the Eurozone, I would say, and UK as well, so I'd probably, you know, couple that as Europe, they had the issue of cost push inflation, very dependent on Russian oil and gas. And then in parts of Asia, they acted quite similarly to what we saw in South Africa, where they didn't have that much of an inflation problem, likely because Asia is still the manufacturing hub of the world. So when everyone else was struggling for components,
they
really had it.
Right.
Precisely. And if you add to that, you know, that the way they actually managed the pandemic also didn't allow demand-led inflation to get out of control. So, yeah, just taking you back into that history of how we got to this point and how South Africa differs from the global stage.
That's fantastic. And I think you touched on quite a lot there in terms of what's actually – What are some of the underlying reasons for what we see happening in global markets today? But I do want to maybe ask Melanie to add on that and just maybe expand a little bit on, from your point of view, what are some of the pressures as well as inflationary shocks, you know, that have contributed most to the inflation situation that we find?
Absolutely. So that was such a great lead, and I almost feel like there's very little I can add to that. We can just wrap the panel up and go home now. But essentially, I mean, all of that is 100% the summary of the story of the past two and a half years. And, you know, when we think about these shocks, that we've discussed already. You know, there were a couple of shocks, and I always think of them as like it's the C's. It's all the C's. We first of all had what we call COVID inflation, which was, you know, this huge demand chasing very few goods because there were no services to spend it on, and these supply chains being broken and dislocated, and they still are in so many parts of the world. You know, that was that initial shock that hit the global economy. Then obviously Russia, Ukraine. Incredibly important for oil prices, which we know reacted sharply and quickly, and then food prices. You know, Ukraine, an incredibly important wheat exporter to the rest of the world, many seeds, and then Russia and Ukraine together, a very important supplier of fertilizer. You know, we only realized how vulnerable we were to fertilizer supply when this happened, and fertilizer so important in the entire agricultural production chain. So, you know, those are really, really big dynamics. And then as Sunisha mentioned, you know, when we look at the inflation baskets of different countries, these shocks impact different countries differently, depending on what the basket looks like. And it actually can be quite varied. So, you know, within emerging markets, much higher percentages of the basket spent on food and fuel. So sub-Saharan Africa, as an example, on average, 40% of the basket is food. Add another 10% in fuel. You've got half of the basket very exposed to the second shock that hit the economy. South Africa, less exposed, kind of 25% if you add those two together. But developed markets like the US would be around about 20-25% to those two. So very different inflation experiences. And also other differences in the basket can be really important. As an example, in the US, used car prices alone, so forget about new, just used is 5% of the basket. It's 0.5% of the basket here. Things like shelter accommodation, so the price of living in a home in the US is over a third of their basket. So there are very big differences between when you're looking at different regions. But I think what is important for us to consider with the second shock being food and fuel, it's quite a dangerous type of inflation for central banks to navigate because it's so tangible. You know, I filled my car up with petrol yesterday, went to the office. The first thing I spoke about was, I can't believe it cost me that much to fill up my car. You know, these things, conversations, dinner tables, everyday conversation, price of food, you know, that gets embedded in the psyche of people when they're thinking about inflation. And, you know, we'll spend some time talking about inflation expectations, but thinking about forward-looking inflation, you know, those types of inflation can be quite dangerous for central banks to navigate, and is one of the reasons why we're seeing quite a wide-awake reaction from central banks, including our own, in response to this.
And I think you're touching on, you know, topics that especially, again, from someone who's not particularly in the investment/finance industry, you're so right, because we're talking about fuel. We're talking about, you know, I never knew, you know, sunflower oil would be this expensive. Can we talk about sunflower oil?
Rationing.
What is happening, right? So these are all the things, though, that you are explaining so eloquently, to say they all have a meaning. They come from these global kind of disruptions that we are seeing, but they are hitting different regions differently depending on kind of one, the mix, the basket mix of, you know, what that region is consuming, what are they producing or not producing as well. So it's quite interesting. But you also touch on the idea of the central bank, right? Which I think we can go into to say, well, how is our central bank dealing with this? Maybe Zasanda, you can come in here. You know, what is happening from our central bank's point of view? How are they dealing with the inflation situation? And also, what's their role? Just so we all understand, what is their role in a inflationary situation that we find ourselves in?
So yeah, Pilar, the neutral thing in all of this is inflation. So the role of the central bank is basically to contain inflation within a target band. So we have seen global inflation rising, the global central banks hiking rates to sort of contain that inflation. And because we don't operate in isolation, and the central bank has to, they have a independence, if you may call it, to sort of maintain.
Yeah.
Because inflation is rising, also it's spilled over to our shores. We've seen rising inflation, and in my view, I think the central bank will not want that inflation to rise, because they have let it. It ran to to levels that we never thought it would get. Yeah. It would get beyond the target band. So what I think is going to happen tomorrow, because the central bank's main target is to control inflation. So I think they're going to hike interest rates so that the economy. You have to look at it at different angles. So we have growth on the other side, which is lagging, and they have revised that lower to 1.7%.
You have the rand prior to the pandemic, right?
Yes, you have a rand weakening on the other side, and you have inflation rising on the other side. Yeah. So the central bank will probably have to sort of tighten their monetary policy and increase rates. I know that is basically lower than what the market expects, because the market expects the sub to sort of hike rates by, I think, 175 basis points to end the repo at 7% or even 7.25 towards the end of the year.
And so you're saying all of this towards you anticipate?
So in the meeting tomorrow, we're basically anticipating a 50 basis point hike. And then leading up to September, because they will need to see if inflation is coming off. But leading up to September, they will probably hike another 50 basis point. And then if it peaks and then it comes off, then they will probably ease on the increments and maybe hike by another 25 basis point.
Sure, very interesting. And I think you touched on the point about the independence. Maybe Sanisha, you can come back here. Is this commonplace across all central banks? You know, the structure of independence, is it commonplace across the world? One, but number two, how does this then, if at all, affect how they react to the situation?
Sure. So, I mean, Zisander pointed out, you know, the main mandate of central banks globally is price stability. Mm-hmm. And that really means, you know, to try and contain costs and protect purchasing power of consumers. And a very key element that Zisander also mentioned is the independence of central banks.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you get some examples across the world where, you know, central banks have gone wrong. And a prime example would be Turkey. And in Turkey's example, we don't have an independent central bank. You actually have President Erdogan telling the central bank what to do on interest rates. At the moment, his belief is that higher interest rates will befall higher inflation rates, which is actually quite contradictory to how most central bank thinking goes. So at the moment, they're sitting with inflation of 74% on the official numbers. Their statistical body believes that inflation is probably higher than 160% right now, and we've seen a massive devaluation in the lira. So this is where, a prime example of, independence gone wrong, and this is the ramifications of poor central bank decision-making. On the opposite end of the spectrum, and I think we should be quite proud to say this, is the South African Reserve Bank, where they have built up an enormous amount of credibility over the last couple of years. And we're seeing that playing out in terms of inflation expectations not ratcheting out of control, like we have seen in a number of other economies. Now, central banks play a very important role in bringing inflation down. They've got a couple of instruments that they can use at their disposal. Obviously, the most common one is interest rates. But back in 2008, the global financial crisis, many central banks ran interest rates to the bone. So we got to the point with which they call the zero lower bound of interest rates, and that meant that they then had to expand their toolkit. And so then they looked at things like tinkering on the balance sheet. And so their toolkit has expanded since that point, and so there are a number of instruments that they can use to control inflation. But I don't necessarily think it's only, monetary policy actors that have a role to play in price stability. I would also say that we've got governments that also have a role to play.
Yeah.
So, throughout the pandemic, we saw governments cutting taxes. They were spending quite a bit into the economy. And now with inflation rates ratcheting higher, I think it's quite important for us to see an element of fiscal discipline.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't really help us if you have central banks that are hiking interest rates and tightening monetary policy. But then on the other hand, you've got fiscal players that continue to spend. So we need to see monetary and fiscal policy working hand in hand in order to curb inflationary pressures in the economy on a global scale. So I would say that that's quite important for them to start looking at raising taxes and to rein in expenditure. In addition to that, and that's sort of the third element, is to factor in growth. And again, Sisanda also pointed out, you know, in the South African context, we also have to be very aware of what high interest rates is going to do to the economic growth outlook. And so I would say it's very important for governments to really embark on structural reforms, particularly in the areas of the labor market and in product markets, so that if we do have, you know, less government spending and we do have more restrictive monetary policy, we can still shelter the growth impact from getting into more restrictive policies.
Makes a lot of sense. Thanks for that. Sisanda, how do nominal and inflation-linked bonds help us kind of get a view of inflation?
So I always say if you hold bonds in your portfolio, then you have taken a bet on inflation. So the different bonds that so you would be exposed to, so the first one would be nominal bonds. So they always sell off in an inflationary environment. Mm-hmm. Because the coupons are not linked to inflation, just like the inflation-linked bonds. So the purchasing power of that bond basically erodes as the inflation rises. And then on the other hand, you have your inflation-linked bonds, which are linked to inflation at the time through the CPI uplift. And as the inflation rises, so you get the benefit of the upside. So we always look at what is called the inflation break-even rate, which is basically your difference between your nominal bonds and your real rates. So it basically, so if the inflation averages above your break-even inflation rate, then you get a benefit. So your inflation-linked bonds will outperform your nominal-linked bonds. So that is where you want to be. So if inflation averages below your break-even inflation rate, then your nominal bonds will sort of outperform. So let's say, for instance, you have, a nominal bond which is trading at 9.5% and an inflation-linked bond or a real rate on inflation-linked at 3.5%, so that's 6%. So that 6% is basically what the market expects inflation to be in the coming 10 years. But you and I, we know that the sub will not run inflation at 6% over 10 years. So that's basically purely market expectation. So it needs to sort of come off. So that is basically what one of the things that that would give us a view. But in a rising interest rate environment, in theory, inflation linked, the curve is supposed to, so only the short to medium points on the curve are supposed to react to the sub raising rates and all of that. But in reality, so just the whole curve just basically reprices. So that tells us that investors are looking for, it's either a market expectation of where the inflation is going to go, or the investors are looking for inflation protection. So it's possible that investors got a shock when inflation runs, and then they need to sort of buy into inflation-linked bonds. So basically what we look at to sort of inform us or to give us a better view of where inflation is going is basically your break-even inflation rate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Peter, I wonder if you don't mind me just adding to that. So just kind of bringing in both these conversations together. Yeah. If we just take a step back and we think central bank independence and why is it important? So yes, we do know we've got an independent central bank, and it's actually an incredibly important part if you think of our ratings matrix when sovereign rating agencies look at South Africa's credit risk. You know, we've seen a slide in our sovereign ratings over the past number of years from investment grade, solid investment grade, all the way to sub-investment grade. One of the offsetting factors to the many risks that we've been facing has been this really strong, credible central bank. So it's important from that point of view. But also, you know, when we are as investors trying to gauge, you know, where are things going to? We've got inflation that's sky high in developed markets. We've got inflation coming into the domestic landscape because food and fuel are now impacting, you know, the domestic price setting. Central banks play a really, really important role in terms of guiding our expectations of future inflation. So they can do nothing about current inflation. So the last headline CPI print in South Africa was 6.5%. We've got a print today. It's going to be north of 7% more than likely. They can't do anything about that. That's happened. You know, that's in the past. If they hike interest rates now, that only impacts inflation 2 quarters to 6 quarters going forward. So that's only in the future.
Yeah.
So, you know, why are they then hiking interest rates now if they might think that inflation might come back down again later? And that's where the linkage comes together about inflation expectations, which it's come up in the panel numerous times already. You know, when central banks look towards the future, the one thing they can do is to prevent economic agents from thinking that current high spot inflation is a permanent feature of the economic landscape. So it's not embedded into the psyche. The psychology of inflation in the market hasn't changed. If central banks have credibility and the market believes that they're going to do what they need to do to bring inflation back down again. And that's critical. And when we're thinking about what's going to guide central banks' decisions going forward, both in South Africa as well as in the US as two key examples, you know, spot inflation is obviously important, but they're going to be guided by what inflation expectations are doing. And we saw that in the Fed when they raised 75 basis points at their last meeting. They mentioned spot inflation, but they also have measures of inflation expectations that they use. University of Michigan consumer inflation expectations is one of them. That had just popped its head up to 3.2% from lower levels. They cited that as one of the reasons. So absolutely key. And then in South Africa as well, the Reserve Bank, the SARB-MPC, at every single meeting, they talk about inflation expectations. And if you think about the hard work that our MPC did to bring inflation expectations down, pre-COVID, we ran interest rates quite high in South Africa relative to what a lot of people were saying we should do to spur growth, so bringing that conversation back into it again. But the reason why they did that is that, you know, initially the market thought that the SARB was targeting 6%. So they had this range, 3 to 6%, but the market, bond markets, everyone believed 6% was actually the number. The current confluence of the MPC said, no, it's not 6%, it's the midpoint of the target range, it's 4.5%. And they worked really hard to bring those inflation expectations down, which is hard to do because if you think about a couple of years ago, every time people demanded wage increases, it was 6% plus. If administered prices were going to be hiked, it was 6% plus. Education, 6% plus. You know, 6% was the target plus, and they had to work hard to bring that inflation expectations number down to 4.5%. They did it, they got there, but now they're obviously worried that that might be at risk because spot inflation is 6.5 going higher, likely to peak in South Africa, possibly 8% in the third quarter of this year. That's a lot above 4.5%, and it's also quite far above the 6% range. And it's going to take a while to bring that back down again, probably by the midpoint of next year, get back to the target range. So quite high for a long period of time. And the types of inflation, food and fuel, spoken about all the time, that explains why the central bank, to keep their credibility intact, is front-loading interest rate hikes. So, you know, we can debate where we think interest rates are going to. We kind of think the terminal rate, so where interest rates will peak in this cycle, will be around about 6.5% to 7%. We haven't changed that view over this time. But how quickly they get there from current levels, 4.75%, to that 6.5% to 7%, they're accelerating that because of all these inflation pressures that are building, because they want to make sure that they can maintain their credibility and keep inflation expectations contained. So, sorry, that's a mouthful, but it's kind of like bringing all of those different things together.
If I can come in there, I think the Reserve Bank would want to avoid the Fed's position in terms of underestimating inflation and also underreacting to control inflation. And therefore, they would want to, so that they can do a catch-up in larger increments. So I think to your point, it's quite fair to say that the Reserve Bank is actually doing a great job in terms of containing inflation.
I would agree with that, absolutely.
And maybe just back to you, Melanie, on this one. How do you see asset class valuations being affected by what we are talking about now in the short, and maybe just try, if you can, if you dare, give us a longer longer-term view of what you expect?
I might sidestep that longer-term view because there's so much uncertainty in the near term. I think that's a big enough challenge to get on top of. But, you know, actually just following up on Susanda's point, which is 100% right, you know, if we think about asset class valuations globally, let's maybe start with equities. Normally, equities can be a decent hedge for inflation. You know, that's what we normally used to, because inflation normally isn't as out of control as it is now. You know, why is high inflation actually negative for equities right right now. So we've seen equity markets down year to date. You know, there are two reasons for that, and they both link to this really, really high inflation. And it comes back to the point, the Fed, they thought inflation was transient. We had that first pandemic shock they thought would work. They were out of the system. We then had the conflict inflation come through this year with oil and food prices going higher. They left it too late. So they've been sitting at 0% interest rates throughout this whole period. They've only started to hike interest rates now. So instead of, you know, gently tapping the brakes, which is what our central bank is doing, anticipating and reacting in advance of inflation rising, they've left it too late and they have to slam the brakes on. So because they're slamming the brakes on, you know, they're sending the message that they need to bring inflation down to maintain their credibility, and they possibly would risk a recession in order to bring inflation down. You know, that's essentially reading the tea leaves, what they're telling us. That's important for valuation. So if you think about equities, you're discounting future cash flow streams. That discount rate has increased dramatically year to date. We've seen a dramatic rise in bond yields. From, you know, COVID, U.S. Treasuries were 0.5%. They went up to 3.5% earlier this year in a very short period of time. You know, in bond market world, this has been like drama, like absolute complete drama. This is important for equity valuations. That's the discount rate. And at the same time, because now we're moving from what was a really strong recovery after the pandemic from an economic growth point of view, by this big rise in interest rates to combat inflation, we now are moving growth slowing, possibly dipping into recession. You know, those earnings that you are discounting are also rolling over. So those are both negative then for equity valuations. Going forward, how this plays out is also quite tricky because, as we all know, over the past, you know, since the global financial crisis, we've had this idea of a Fed put, right? So every time economic growth slows, the Fed comes in and props growth up again. Because inflation is so high and because labor markets are so tight in the U.S., that's the dual mandate of the Fed, they're so far away from both of their mandates, they don't have the luxury of doing that anymore. They have to continue to hike until inflation, they say, meaningfully shows signs of falling. We're not there yet. Yep. So you don't have that Fed put. So in the near term, it just presents nothing but a headwind to equity valuations. Maybe leaving equity aside for one second, let's move to things like credit markets. You know, credit markets globally have also had a very interesting decade, or probably since the GFC, where we saw, you know, Sunisha was mentioning all these extraordinary policy tools that central banks could use. That impacted credit markets. So there are three big supports, or a couple of big supports to credit markets globally, and we saw credit spreads globally come into incredibly tight levels. So if we take something like the iTraxx crossover spread, which is just a measure of credit spreads, you know, that went as low as 200 basis points 2019, 2020. It shot up recently to 600, just to give you a feeling for magnitude. And why are we seeing these big changes in credit markets? Well, it had been supported by a couple of factors. One was negative interest rates or negative yields globally. In the past decade. So we saw, for example, the European Central Bank cut rates into negative territory, so negative yields. That spilled over to other asset classes, and at the same time, central banks were using quantitative easing. They were purchasing all sorts of assets in the market, which drove yields low at the same time. So it really made cash, I would say, as an uninvestable asset class. So people were pushed out, investors pushed out from cash into higher risk investments, which impacted the credit market. Credit spreads came into really, really tight levels. And growth was very strong. And then in COVID, the toolboxes widened even further. And suddenly central banks were actually buying corporate bonds, not just sovereign debt. So it was, when I say extraordinary, I mean extraordinary. It was a very non-ordinary time period that we were living in. And if you think of those factors, those are now all changing. So because of inflation, rates rising dramatically, moving out of negative yielding territory. You know, at one point in 2019, if we take all the sovereign debt that trades in the global market, not just sovereign, let's take all the investment grade debt trading in the global market that's listed, 30% of that, so a third of that, was trading at negative yields. That's crazy when you think about it. That's now down close to 0%. So that's completely turned. Central banks, because of inflation, they're not conducting quantitative tightening. So instead of quantitative easing, where they purchase assets in the market, they're now selling those back in again and stopping their purchases. So that's the second pillar of support. And at the same time, we were speaking about, you know, recession risks rising, growth slowing. It's worse for corporate earnings. That's not great for credit spreads either. So that's why all of that is unwind very quickly and all at the same time. In South African credit, we live in a different universe. We don't really have a functioning credit market. If you look at SA credit spreads of corporates that issue, and I'd love the rest of the panel to give chip in on their views, it doesn't tell you anything. There's very little issuance into the market because growth is so low, fixed investment is so low, corporates don't have that much confidence about the future, so we don't really have a thriving credit market. So all of this action we've seen in global credit spreads hasn't translated at all through to the domestic market, but for the wrong reasons as opposed to the right ones.
And also there's a disconnect in terms of what the investors are looking for in the corporate bond in the corporate market. So the investors are still stuck in the past where they want higher than or during COVID or COVID peak kind of spreads, and the issuers are not there yet. So some of the balance sheets have sort of improved and survived the COVID times, but the investors are not they're still stuck in the past. So they're basically looking for excess yields.
Well, maybe a slightly, and I know this is a tough one to ask to you, Sanisha. I know you mentioned so many moving parts in the beginning. We spoke about Russia, Ukraine. We spoke about the global supply chain issues that we had due to COVID. We spoke COVID itself, how it impacted different markets. But from your point of view, how long do you anticipate this period of rapid inflation to last, and if anything, what are you looking at? What kind of variables are you looking at that could affect how long or short this period kind of gets past?
Sure. So, looking into the crystal ball, if you look at the Bloomberg consensus numbers out there, so it's sort of the blue chip consensus, or I guess the Wall Street mainstream economists, it does appear as though the consensus believes that inflation, especially in the U.S., has peaked already for the second quarter of the year. But the trick in this is that inflation is probably going to remain sticky for longer than what we all initially envisaged. Yeah. So at the beginning, we expected that very high base that was created by the oil price would then start to see quite a sharp slowdown in inflation in the second half of this year. But we're unlikely to see that very sharp deceleration happening because of inflation pressures that have broadened into the rest of the basket. So there are, there's an element of sticky price pressures that will still be inherent in the basket for the remainder of this year. And so we believe that inflation could remain higher for longer, even though the peak is predominantly likely past behind us already. So if you look at the U.S. as an example, the elements that are more sticky in that basket would be things like rental inflation. I know Melanie also picked up on that earlier, where she spoke about, the owner's equivalent rental inflation being quite a big portion of the basket in the U.S. I think it's almost 30%. And there we're expecting, rental inflation to play quite an important role in keeping headline inflation high. If you think about all of the sectors that were affected by the pandemic, so hotel costs or airfares, if you think about car rental prices, which Melanie also picked up on, those elements are likely to persist in the basket for a little bit longer before they start rolling off the base. I think it's quite important to look at where inflation expectations are at least a year ahead. So if you look at those Bloomberg figures for the end of next year, they're still close to about 3%. Now, earlier on, we spoke about the Federal Reserve's target being around 2%. And so this really brings about the debate of, is 3% then the new 2%? So as Melanie pointed out earlier, if the central bank in the U.S. feels comfortable that inflation will be around 2% on a more sustainable basis, they can then take their foot off the brake. But we may actually be entering an environment where they will start taking their foot off the brake when they can see inflation getting to a more sustainable level at 3%. Yeah. Why? Because they are worried about higher interest rates negatively impacting growth and the rising risk of, recession fears that are coming about. Right. So I think that's also a dynamic that has shifted this time around to the previous monetary policy regime that we've been seeing. Now, how long will we see this inflation persistent? I think there are a couple of flags that we can watch out for now. Again, Melanie also pointed, you know, like the horse has already bolted on headline inflation. There's nothing that central bank monetary policy can do to affect the current inflation print that maybe comes out later today. There's not much that monetary policy can do for this inflation print. But where monetary policy can have more of an impact is on future inflation and the expectations around that. So going forward, you know, we want to see that the first round inflation impacts coming through from food and fuel do not become entrenched in the economy. So in other words, getting a grip on wage inflation, making sure that services inflation does not run away, curbing inflation expectations. If those elements, if wage inflation starts picking up further, if we see services inflation becoming de-anchored, if we see inflation expectations ratcheting higher, then inflation persistence can be with us for a longer period. So those are the flags that I would say that we need to watch out for.
Fantastic. And perhaps just to add, just to finish that off as well. So yes, I suppose the one good thing, so is there any silver lining to this? So inflation high, expectations at risk of becoming unanchored, central banks fighting hard against that, but these types of inflation are very personal and tangible. The good news is that at least if we look at the sort of the big, that conflict inflation shock, food and oil prices, if we look at wheat prices as a proxy for food and we look at oil prices, they're back to pre-invasion levels or thereabouts, you know, or maybe slightly higher. So that's good. So we had this huge shift up and they've come down. The bad news is the reason why they've come down is recession fears, which isn't always like the best reason, but at least it's working. So, you know, if we have to look going forward into the future in terms of, you know, what is the momentum in the future once we work through this period of higher prints in the inflation basket, at least that is some reason for hope, is that both of those have moved comfortably lower.
Awesome. I do want to open for questions, but before I do that, ladies, just one final thought. You know, it could really be about anything that you want to share with the audience or, you know, on your particular readings that you've been doing, anything that you find interesting. You know, what is the one thing you'd like to really leave this conference with, leave our audience with to consider? Zisanda, maybe I'll start with you.
From my side, I would just say, I would give an investment advice.
There we go.
Don't, look through the noise and invest long term. Just keep your focus on the long term returns.
Stay on the path.
Stay on the path.
There we go. Sanisha?
You know, we spoke about watching flags earlier on. So I would say there are a couple of things that we can watch out for as future indicators. So I bucket those into two mainstream buckets. So the first is really to look at the element of risk aversion, because the symptoms of risk aversion are coming out with, you know, the dollar hitting parity with the euro last week as an example. So look at things like geopolitical risk factors. Look at things like market risk, the VIX, which is a volatility index, a bit of a fear gauge. Look at the emerging market bond index spread. That tells us how much risk is embedded in the markets and in emerging markets relative to developed market economies. The other bucket, I would then look at things like sentiment indicators, because that tells us where the real economy is headed. Currently, with people being very worried about recession, this has also come about on the back of consumer sentiment tanking in the US, business confidence also falling quite significantly. If I can latch on to Sizanda's investment advice, you know, I think, you know, people get very worried watching their portfolios when we hit equity market dips. But I think we need to remember that over the long term, equity returns can be very beneficial for portfolios. And yes, the market is going to dip from time to time, but it doesn't mean that investors have to react to every dip. So, I mean, my advice here would be to steer away from short-term recency bias and to really focus more on rational long-termism, because over the long term, equity markets can actually give you quite a decent return.
Because you can do quite a bit of harm, right, if you
precisely. I mean, you know, internally, one of our teams did a study looking at how you can destroy value in your portfolio by incorrect market timing, which is based on investor fear rather than investor rationality. And in order to avoid that, you know, as Sizanda says, you know, stay the course.
Perfect.
Yeah, so I suppose just following on from that theme of rationality, so how do we make rational decisions at times like these? And I say, well, thank goodness for the credibility and independence of central banks, because that gives us guardrails. So if we believe in the SARB targeting 4.5% inflation and that they've got credibility in doing that, we can make rational investment decisions around that. So we can look in the bond market as an example. I'm a bond girl, so forget equity markets. Invest in bonds because they're very attractive. But if why am I saying bonds are attractive? If we look at long-dated SA bond yields, so trading out at the longer end of the curve, those are close to a 12% nominal yield, which is incredibly high. We are suffering a bit of an emerging market debt sell-off at this point, and we're caught up in that, which has taken us to these levels. But why do we think 12% is attractive? If we think inflation is, let's just say 4.5% to 5%, arguably 5%, that gets you a 7% real yield investing in South African nominal bonds. And if you think about how a lot of our mandates are set up in terms of benchmarks, you get a CPI plus 3, a CPI plus 4, a CPI plus 5. Here you're getting CPI plus 7 if the central bank is credible and achieves their target. So that's something to think about, and it gives us guardrails to make appropriate investment decisions around.
Fantastic. Well, with that being said, I think it's a good time now to perhaps open to the audience. I see my brother there. We've got a first question over here. Can I just see by a show of hands who would like to pose a question? Okay, I'd like to see number two there. Anyone else? Okay, three. Thank you. Okay, I'll pause there maybe for now, and then we'll see if anyone else wants to go ahead.
Don't think you'll have time for all the questions. thanks for a very engaging panel to the panelists. There was quite a bit of time spent on the Saab, the Fed, with a close third being Turkey. As central banks, what I'm keen to understand is how the ECB, in the complexity of management within that space, as well as the protection of weaker economies, maintains credibility in effecting that mandate of controlling inflation expectations.
What I'll do is, who would
shall
like
we let the economist
that?
Answer that?
Sure, you can go ahead and take that one. Maybe can we pause and just take the second question? Sir, you may go ahead.
Thanks. I tend to agree with the view that the Fed has acted too late in terms of normalizing their monetary policy, and just maybe taking a cynical view. Do you perhaps think that, this is probably, high inflation is probably something developed market countries wanted, so that especially those with high debt levels, and high inflation could help them just inflate their debt levels away in real terms. And perhaps that even though inflation, some market commentators feel, have peaked in the US, perhaps they won't go back down within the band, and that the Fed may and developed markets may actually keep inflation high for extended periods to help them with the debt situation.
I can take a stab at that.
Just hold on. And I just want to grab all the questions. Chris, there's a third one here. And then we can just...
I'm wondering about South Africa's increasing alignment with BRICS and kind of the other parts of the global economy where data and all of that is far less accessible. So looking far into the future, to what extent do you think we need to become more and more aware of what's happening in the Chinese, Indian, Brazilian, et cetera, economies, because that's going to drive the economics here? And to what extent can that translate to start to drive the financial markets, which are usually far more predicated on the easier data flows from Europe and the US, but maybe that's not what the future looks like.
Okay. Sanisha, can you take the first one and the third one? Okay.
I'll add my 10 cents of economics in here. On the ECB, they're in quite a quandary right now, because we've seen Italian and Spanish and to a certain extent Greece, their spreads also rose quite significantly. So, on the one hand, they've got rising inflation, which is a massive problem, obviously, for purchasing power of consumers, and they have to protect price stability. And on the other side of this coin, they were propping up many of these southern European economies by purchasing bonds. So, you know, this week we're expecting to hear what tool set the ECB is going to come up with now to deal with both of these problems. We still expect central banks to focus on inflation and keep that as their main target right now, even if they do have dual mandates and have to worry about growth. But for as long as inflation is as high as it is, we do believe that they will act on that and growth will be a secondary factor. It's going to be quite interesting to see how the ECB plays out with this, because at the same time they've got to rein in inflation, but they can't let these economies slip. So, I mean, Italy is a perfect example because, you know, it's been seen as too big to fail, but there's a real problem here. We know that the Eurozone was problematic to begin with because the fiscal and monetary union didn't really work out, and now we're starting to see signs of those pressures emerging. So, yeah, as I say, you know, the ECB is in quite a quandary right now because they are struggling with the southern European countries that were propped up by cheap and easy money. But at the same time, they've got to start reversing those balance sheet transactions in order to rein in inflation. Maybe I can just very quickly touch on the other questions around the debt issue. Again, I think I'll bring it back to the point that even though central banks do in some cases have a dual mandate, I believe that for as long as inflation is running as hot as it is, the inflation part of that component is going to take the frontal space right now, and growth will take a bit of a backseat. And that's why, you know, you're starting to hear some of the commentary coming out in the U.S. that they may have to almost engineer some sort of soft landing in order to get inflation under control. I think some countries like Germany, for example, you know, hyperinflation is still very much in their memory. And I don't think they want to tinker with the possibility of a stagflation scenario. So if you think inflation is pretty bad, but stagflation is even worse, because now you're going to have the worst of all factors, because you're going to have very, very high inflation. You are also going to have very, very weak growth, and it's very difficult to get out of that negative spiral. And then on the third question around the BRICS alliance, I mean, the one thing that really came out from the Russia-Ukrainian crisis is that we have left the West-centric world, and we are entering a multipolar world. I think this is going to affect a number of issues, such as, you know, global goals on things like climate change, on social development, because ordinarily everything was dictated by this West-centric world. And now we're starting to see countries in parts of South America and Africa siding with Asia rather than going with the West. And I think what we're going to see playing out is when things are more favorable for these economies to side with the East, they'll do it. And when it's more favorable for them to side with the West, they will do it. And this brings a very high element of geopolitical uncertainty into play. So I think that risk premiums are going to be high going forward because of that risk inherent in markets. So that's just my consensus.
Yeah, so completely agree with all of that. And perhaps just adding maybe one or two points onto that train of thought. You know, if we think about the debt stock that's been accumulated by developed markets, I think there could have been some of that cynicism when the Fed was, they had blinkers on. They said transient inflation, we're not worried, we're keeping rates at zero despite inflation being high. And I think they've proven themselves to us that that's not the case. The inflation is top of mind for them, and they're going to raise rates and do what they need to do to bring inflation down. So I think less of a worry that they're trying to deflate their debt stock. But the size of their debt stock is important because the sensitivity of the economy to higher rates is much higher when you have a very high debt stock. So, you know, you don't need much of an increase in U.S. Treasuries feeding through to mortgage rates to have a larger impact on economic growth. I think that's important for us to understand. And also, if we do enter into a recession now, you know, what type of recession will that look like? Is it going to be deep or is it not? We don't really have a lot of imbalances built up on corporate balance sheets, as well as the private balance sheet, the consumer balance sheet, because they came out of COVID reasonably strong with all the transfers and so on. But I think that because of that high debt stock, central banks have got less flexibility to intervene by cutting interest rates significantly and or doing more quantitative easing in the market. I think all of these things are linked together. So getting out of a recession, there are less tools, given the high inflation backdrop, that central banks normally have going into this type of of environment. So it's just important to understand the linkages of all of those. And then very quickly on the ECB, 100% right, they are the worst of the lot in terms of having their backs up against the wall. So they've got high inflation, but they're at the center of the storm of everything that's happening in Europe with they're very reliant on gas from Russia. So the impact, the negative impact on the economy is outsized relative to other economies. So they've got to balance these two, and there's no easy way for them to answer that. So very tricky environment for them.
Well, there we go. Thank you so much, ladies. That goes on and wraps up this particular session, or panel discussion, of course, on inflation. Please help me just say thanks to our panelists. I think it was a very fruitful discussion. I'd like to end here for now, please. Thank you so much.